Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On March 14th, 2019, three astronauts launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan.
Engine defect, someone with thrust, liftoff.
And liftoff. We have liftoff of Nick Hay, Christina Cook, and Alexei Ovchinin, now on their way to the International Space Station.
The three astronauts did indeed dock at the International Space Station, and a 328 record-breaking days later, NASA astronaut Christina Cook returned to Earth. She spent almost a year in a form of scientifically splendid isolation, advancing humanity's knowledge about space on the ISS, and then she came back to a planet soon after her touchdown where humanity retreated into homes and hospitals to fight the coronavirus. So what lessons and insights does this space pioneer have for all of us about isolation, about reentry into society, and about the strengths and weaknesses and fragilities of life on planet Earth? This hour on Point, we'll have a conversation with astronaut Christina Cook. And she joins us today from Galveston, Texas. Christina Cook, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Great to be with you.
I'm so excited to talk to you. Everyone knows I'm a complete space freak, so I'm going to take some deep breaths and just ask you a simple question to begin with, which is, for you, what is more challenging or what was more challenging? Being relatively isolated on the International Space Station or stay-at-home orders in Texas?
Yep. Well, I would say that, of course, both present their own unique challenges. Interestingly, being isolated on board the space station, you are a lot farther from your friends, your family, your support network in a physical terms. But the rest of the world, for the most part, during my mission was running. So, for example, something I shared recently is that while I may have been far from all of the, you know, earthly niceties, I was able to at least watch live sports on TV and feel connected in that way. You know, being at the stay-at-home orders really, for me, has actually offered a lot more than the isolation that I experienced for 11 months on board the International Space Station. So while it's a lot less than what I thought I might be coming home to, comparatively, it's actually given me quite a bit to take in. And looking at the positive side, it's allowed me to really get comfortable with my home life, to reintegrate in my home and in my neighborhood. So I take it with appreciation in that sense.
Okay, so is that what you mean by when you say home life is a lot more now than it would have otherwise been?
Well, I mean, home life, you know, the things that I expected to be able to do when I returned, like traveling, getting to do outreach and share my story more widely in a physical sense and be with people in that sense, being able to go into work every day, those things aren't necessarily available to me like I thought they would be. But the rest of the things I can experience, I can eat normal food, I can make phone calls, I can experience nature outside in my neighborhood. And so, you know, in some ways, it's so much more than what I had on board the International Space Station, even if it's not everything that I had expected.
I see. Okay. About the food part, this is just a little a tangent here. I thought I saw a video of astronauts like making pizzas on the ISS.
Yes, occasionally we do something special like making pizzas, often to celebrate a birthday or special occasion, or maybe to celebrate an accomplishment like a series of spacewalks wrapping up or a busy time. And yeah, we have some techniques for that. We often use tortillas as our pizza crusts and clips to clip them down onto Velcro to stay near the table while we construct our pizza with the toppings. And then if we're careful and we use tin foil to cover the pizza on top, we can actually use our space oven with its little clamps and keep the pizza next to the hot plate so that it can cook properly. It's a lot of fun.
Pizzas in space. I love it. Okay, so folks, we are talking with Christina Cook this hour. She's the NASA astronaut who currently holds the world record for the longest continuous journey in space for a woman, 328 days that she was on the International Space Station. So what questions do you have for astronaut Cook about the work and her experience on the ISS, about reentry and return to planet Earth, about challenges, mental and physical, when it comes to isolation? Now, Christina, if we could, I kind of want to have this conversation in three phases, okay? And the first is, I would just love to hear from you a lot about the work that you did in those 328 days on the ISS. I mean, first and foremost, on that launch day, March 2019, what was it like when you first docked with the International Space Station and realized, you know, your mission, it had begun previously, but like this was the first big step?
Absolutely. You know, on the way up to the space station, which takes about 6 hours from the time of launch to getting to the space station, the two most amazing things I saw were the Earth below me and the International Space Station itself. The first time you viewed it, it was just floating in a sea of blackness, and I couldn't believe it was real. It was an engineering marvel, and it was exactly like all the little models made it look like. And then to come in and to rendezvous with the space station to slowly raise our orbit to meet its, and then to begin an automated docking sequence where we slowly came closer and closer to the space station was an absolutely amazing feeling. That was kind of the first moment where I realized that surreal was going to be the new real. And I've been living kind of in that kind of a reality ever since. And docking with it, trusting the systems, trusting our training, and knowing that pretty soon we would open the hatch and start kind of in a new world, start this life that we've been preparing for so many years. We knew that our friends would be across that hatch and that they would take care of us and that we would soon get started getting to finally fulfill our purpose and our mission.
Surreal would be the new real. So, but you train intensively for years before that to cope with the immediate disorientation you're going to feel, right?
Yes, that's true. The physical disorientation, there's not a lot that you can do to physically prepare for it, but we can talk to our colleagues and learn about what to expect. However, it is different for everyone. So part of, you know, what we learn as astronauts is to be adaptable, to be able to adapt our behavior to whatever we come into contact with. And that can include our own bodies getting used to microgravity and the adaptations that take place there. But yes, we are definitely highly trained to do the work of our job. And there's not really much time before we set right into that. There's about a day in the plan where you can kind of get your body oriented and relearn how to live and how to be in microgravity. And then you do go straight to work.
What is it like that first moment where there's no up, there's no down, the usual tools that we use to orient ourselves, like horizon lines, all gone? What does that feel like?
It is definitely disorienting. It's kind of fun to watch new folks arrive on space station because everyone's learning how to float. We're all learning how to operate our bodies without gravity pulling us down. And one of the interesting things is that in 1G, you don't realize that you're actually counteracting gravity by holding your own body up. And so when you get to microgravity, it actually feels like there's a force pushing you up in a lot of ways, but it's actually just completely neutral. So once you learn how to kind of counteract that initial experience, it goes a lot faster. But, you know, learning to flip around, we had a phrase on board where if we were floating by something and we meant to catch a handrail and didn't quite make it, we would call out free drift so that everyone in front of us knew to watch out for us and either slow us down or get out of the way. So it's a lot of fun. And just like anything, the amazing part is the human body's ability to adapt.
Well, yeah, I was just going to ask about that because the disorientation soon becomes your new orientation, right? And how long did it take you to get used to the no up or down of space?
Yes, exactly. I would say in the first couple of days, you get used to the idea of not having a definite up or down defined by a gravity vector. We do have a convention on board the space station to call the Earth-facing side of station the deck and the opposite side overhead, what would be the ceiling. The difference is there are science experiments and equipment and things you need and stowage on all sides. So you might just pop up to the ceiling and open up a cabinet just like you would if it were a cabinet on the wall on Earth. So every once in a while, when you did that kind of Spider-Man move, the entire station would almost seem to flip around. And now you would feel like you were on the floor or on the wall rather than on the ceiling. And so you'd have to actually come down and re-visually orient so that you could, you know, reorient with up or down and not get dizzy.
Yeah. So I have to say, a while ago, about a year ago, there was a traveling NASA exhibit that came through the Museum of Science here in Boston, where I'm located. And it was about life on the ISS. And they had this big simulation, a module of a portion of the ISS, and you could actually walk into it, and they spun it around. So we still had gravity, but we were experiencing that spinning that you're talking about. And I got sick pretty much instantaneously, or really dizzy, pretty much instantaneously. So I can't imagine what that's like to have both that visual cue and then the loss of gravity underneath your feet at the same time. It's kind of amazing.
Absolutely. Yes, it is. And the neat thing is that the human body adapts by actually stopping listening to the vestibular system. So your mind actually, you know, decides that that vestibular sensor is no longer reliable. So let's stop listening to it. And that's where actually when you readapt to gravity on Earth, you have to relearn how to use your systems. So that's kind of the way that we get around that feeling that you experienced.
Okay, that's so fascinating. And then, look, there is a for those of us still Earthside who think about the experiences that astronauts have, there is a profound desire to think that it's an immediately spiritual, romantic, transformative experience. I mean, did you have that sort of sense of awe the first time you turned around and were able to just really look back at planet Earth?
I did. That feeling for me came in the Soyuz capsule long before I even got to the space station, a couple hours before we docked. And I opened the little window next to my seat and I exclaimed, because it was the first time I saw the Earth below. It was very bright. It was absolutely stunningly beautiful. And exclaiming in a small spacecraft is not what you want to do to reassure your crewmates that everything is okay. So I soon had to let them know that there were no issues. I was just seeing planet Earth for the first time.
Wow. But in reality, hang on for a second, Christina, if you can. Yes. Okay, I'm so sorry. We've got to take a quick break. I'll let you finish that thought when we come back. We are talking with astronaut Christina Cook. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with astronaut Christina Cook. She is the NASA astronaut who holds the record for the longest continuous space flight for any woman ever, 328 days. And she set that record upon her return to Earth in February of this year, just before the rest of humanity went into lockdown due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And astronaut Cook joins us today from Galveston, Texas. And Christina, you were talking about in the Soyuz craft, looking back and exclaiming the first time you saw Earth. And I had to cut you off before the break there. I'm sorry, but go ahead and finish that story.
Sure. You know, your question about the spiritual aspects and the kind of big picture of looking back at Earth. And it's interesting because though we do have those moments, we're very busy. We work on science, maintenance, upgrades of the International Space Station, and our time is scheduled in 12-hour days down to the 5-minute increments. So though we do have time for some of that, a lot of what we do is very practical, just trying to be as efficient as possible, you know, carrying out the science that we do up there.
Mm. So tell me more about that, because I think that's one thing that that people maybe don't realize is how planned and scheduled and structured life is on the ISS. I mean, it has to be. Is it down to what, half an hour increments? What's it like in the quote unquote morning when you get up to start a day's work on the International Space Station?
Well, interestingly, it's probably like a lot of mornings that many people working from home are having right now, because obviously our workplace is also our personal space there and our living quarters. But just like any other morning, get up, get ready, maybe have a little breakfast with your crewmates, and then it's off to work starting at what we call 7:30 in the morning. And yes, our time is scheduled down to 5-minute increments, and that's because we work in such concert with ground teams. Mm. The science that we do, the maintenance that we do, it's all highly choreographed. And to make the most of every minute and every day on board the space station, all of it is pre-planned exquisitely. You know, we are stewards of this amazing international laboratory that's bringing benefits back to Earth. And to make that run as efficiently as possible and get our return on investment, we really buckle down during the days when we're up there.
And so it's 5-minute increments of everything from experiments to when you're going to eat, when you take your exercise breaks, that kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. It even specifies our sleep period, our post-sleep and pre-sleep periods, which a lot of friends of mine thought was pretty funny. But during the workday portion, it does include exactly what you mentioned, maintenance and upgrades to space station to keep it running at its peak performance itself as the infrastructure and the kind of engineering marvel that supports the science, and then as much scientific utilization as possible. So we are constantly working on a wide variety of scientific instruments and experiments that can only be done in microgravity, that basically, you know, having gravity as a variable can teach us about fundamental processes, about our bodies, about pharmaceuticals, about technology. And then, yes, even other things are scheduled, our meals, our times to get ready in the morning. And another big part of that is our own exercise. We have to exercise about 2 hours a day, and that's a countermeasure to the effects of microgravity on the body that would otherwise cause muscle and bone atrophy.
Yeah. So I want to talk more about some of your favorite experiments that you did in the 11 months that you were in space in just a minute. But it seems that precision and scheduling are really, really important parts of how to keep life and science going in an extremely confined environment like the International Space Station. It makes complete sense because there's teamwork going on in orbit and back here on Earth. But to me, I've always wondered, the biggest wild card in all of this is other human beings, right? So what do you do? What does conflict resolution look like in near Earth orbit?
Yes. That's true. And that's something that NASA really focuses on. We do a lot of training in what we call expeditionary behavior skills. So these are skills that make sure that the interpersonal aspects of our job allow us to, again, operate as efficiently as possible and at our peak throughout the mission. So these are things like communication, group living, leadership, followership, self-care, team care, things that make sure that we all as a team are running like a well-oiled machine. So we're taught to communicate really openly. We're taught to identify any barriers to efficient work and working together. And we really truly feel like we are on a team, both between ourselves as a crew, with our ground teams that provide our schedule and queue up everything that we do, and the trainers that got us there, that provided us with the skills that we need. You know, every day I thought about making sure that I made those trainers proud by bringing my best. So that's really the focus on expeditionary behavior skills, is what allows us to make sure that those human factors don't impact the science work we're doing.
If I may ask, did you ever have to put those skills into practice?
Well, as you can imagine, just like a lot of people probably working from home now, I'm putting those skills into practice all the time. I think that if I weren't, I wouldn't have been doing my job. Yeah. I think, you know, when you live with other people in such close proximity, there's definitely going to be things that come up. And I think the important part is to look at it as a professional skill and responsibility to handle those things professionally. Okay. You know, during my time on orbit, I was there for 11 months and I only saw and worked with 11 other people. So you can imagine that with that kind of level of interaction, there's always opportunities to exercise those skills.
Expeditionary behavior skills. I think we all need to take a course in that. All of us, like all 7 billion human beings on planet Earth right now. That is the most useful thing I've heard in a while. Okay, so let's go to the phones, Christina, because Joe from Portland, Maine has a question along these lines. Joe, go ahead.
Hi. I heard your discussion about the interactions up there, but as we all know that even though we're taught certain things, we're human. And in our humanity, there are times, especially when we're under stress or with someone 24/7, it doesn't work out that well. Were there times when you noticed other people in stressful situations who gave into the situations, and how was that toned down during the course of time they were on the space station with you or each other?
Yep, absolutely. Again, just like we're probably all experiencing as we're all staying at home with a small group of people, there are definitely instances, especially under stress, where you can see that happen. And I would say I'm a perfect example of that. There were times when I would talk to crewmates about how leading up to stressful dynamic events, our behavior would change, our tempo and the way we interacted with each other would change. And so recognizing that and coming up with countermeasures and strategies to actually implement during those times of high stress, and to treat it as a very kind of almost like a physical process, knowing that it's going to happen, having countermeasures and being willing to apply those even when you might not feel like it, were how we as a crew got through those tough times.
So fascinating and so applicable, like you keep saying, to everyone here now. Joe, thank you for that call. Christina, what were some of your favorite experiments that you did on the ISS?
Well, there were so many. We do things, everything from physical science to technology demonstrations, human research, and biology and biotechnology. As someone who's trained as an electrical engineer and physicist, I personally love all the physical science things, you know, having a chance to really probe some of those fundamental properties of things that we can't on Earth because gravity kind of confounds the equation, if you will. And then taking those things and applying them to industries because, you know, everyone needs that edge in industry, and understanding things to their fundamental degree is really what I think a lot of our factory processes, our manufacturing processes can benefit from. But I would say, given all that, the things I enjoyed working on the most up there were often things that had tangible benefits for, say, pharmaceutical research and combating some of the most common diseases that we all face. One of them is called microgravity crystals, because as you might imagine, protein crystals grow much better in microgravity than on Earth. Mm. And growing these protein crystals can often be a key in coming up with new drugs or countermeasures for things like cancer or neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. So recognizing that I may be able to contribute to state of the art for fighting those diseases was really meaningful to me.
Wow. Let's go back to the phones. Maggie is calling from Gillsville, Georgia. Maggie, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I agree. I am the biggest science geek in the world, and to be able to talk to a real-life astronaut is probably one of the highest points ever in life. Thank you so much for everything you did, and congratulations on your record. I have a question for you after going to Kennedy Space Center and getting kicked out because I was just so enthralled. What surprised you the most, inside or out, when you were in space?
Well, thank you. First of all, it's great to be speaking with you as well. There were so many things that were a surprise, obviously. I think one of the biggest surprises was how well the human body adapts to microgravity. And we've talked about that a little bit. Another big surprise was how breathtaking and how meaningful it was looking down on Earth at places I considered my home, seeing where I grew up for the first time, seeing where my loved ones were living. All that really had a profound effect on me because it meant seeing those places in the perspective of where they really fell on a universal stage. That was something that really, really surprised me.
Almost every astronaut who I've heard speak about this says exactly that, Christina. There's something just I don't know what the right word is, but it hits your soul to see the Earth against the blackness of space, the vacuum, the emptiness of space. And you just think there's no more powerful realization than that, than this is all we've got. This little rock is all we've got.
Yes, absolutely. It is definitely something profound. You recognize that it sustains us. You know, there is such a thing as a global scale. When you can look down on the Earth and you see things beyond the regional scale, beyond the continental scale, but in the global scale, you recognize that that global scale means that the Earth can provide all the things that we as humanity need. And in that sense, it unites us. But in the same token, that providing of what we need isn't necessarily guaranteed. When you notice it on the universal scale and with the universal backdrop, you see the thin blue line that defines our atmosphere, and you recognize there's complex systems in that atmosphere that provide us everything we need. But just as that global scale is, you know, can provide a backdrop for things that we need, it also could potentially not provide the things we need, and it could potentially throw us curveballs that are also on a global scale.
Like we're the curveball that we're all experiencing right now, I would say, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you, Christina, the view from inside the ISS is one thing, one magnificent thing. You also went on, a total of 6 spacewalks during your mission, including the first all-woman spacewalk with your fellow astronaut, Jessica Meir. What was that like?
Well, you're right. And spacewalks are really one of the most exceptional experiences that any astronaut can have the honor of doing, you know, and it's a combination of a lot of things. It's the amazing beauty that you're seeing and seeing it in an immersed environment. After looking out the window only for so long, you finally find yourself in the environment that you've been looking at, kind of, but without that veil of seeing it through a window. And then the other parts about it are that you've got a mission to do that's really important, and you're doing it in a risky environment. And every little movement you do is difficult. It's all a delicate task. So my strategy was to recognize the exquisite opportunity I had to contribute and in the environment I was contributing to it. And then basically to just focus, get to work, and pay attention to the tasks at hand and make sure that me and my crewmates were safe and getting the job done.
Now, I just got to ask, I don't want to drag politics into this, but I have to just a little bit, because one of the spacewalks that you were scheduled to do, which I think was supposed to have been done early in your mission with astronaut McLean as well, was the one that had to get canceled because there weren't two suits to fit the sizes needed for 2 female astronauts. Is that right?
Well, the spacewalk did happen. It was just crewed differently. So I did the spacewalk with my crewmate, Nick Hague, rather than Anne McLean. But yes, you're right. It had been scheduled to be Anne McLean and I, and then the crew was changed due to, like you mentioned, those spacesuit resources.
Okay. So let's take this and transform it into a learning moment for NASA or for the international community of scientists and engineers who want to send astronauts to Mars, for example. I mean, was it a learning moment in terms of providing the kinds of resources and supplies that would be needed for any eventuality? Because you can't really fully anticipate who's going to need to go on spacewalks in the event of an emergency, for example.
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, it was an amazing teachable moment, if you will, in one sense, because Anne McLean was actually the person that made the call to not do the spacewalk in a size that was slightly bigger for her. And the fact that NASA completely went with her judgment and changed the plan, was nimble enough to come up with a new plan and keep the spacewalk as scheduled, I think is a real testament to the fact that we trust in the people that are on the ground or in space, if you will, making those real-time decisions with the resources that we have. And secondly, absolutely. So the next generation of spacesuit is called the XEMU. It stands for the Exploration EMU, and EMU is an acronym that we use for our extravehicular spacesuits or spacewalk suits. And the new strategy that NASA is using to develop that suit is to, one, make a wider range of sizes that fits a very wide breadth of different human sizes. And secondly, and most importantly, to start that development with a small size and then scale up from there. One of the historical legacies of the current spacewalking spacesuit is that it was started in kind of a middle range size and then attempted to scale down. And they actually came up against some technological and technology and engineering challenges with actually scaling it down. And that's one of the reasons that we're left in this time with kind of a spacesuit fleet that doesn't necessarily fit smaller bodies as well.
That makes a lot of sense. Make the suit adaptable, of course, right? It's a completely logical path to follow here. I'm curious about on your spacewalks. I mean, obviously, those are also very closely, well planned, very precisely planned, too, in terms of the objective of the spacewalk. But did things go wrong there? I mean, every movie about space has had like astronauts losing wrenches and stuff just floating off into their own orbits. Did anything like that happen?
Right. Well, it's interesting that we always say the best spacewalks are the most boring spacewalks, because that means we didn't have anything like that happening. You're right. They're very planned. There's always things that come up that aren't necessarily expected, but we do simulation events so that we are ready for almost any of those things that could happen. The whole team on the ground is ready to pivot to a solution or a workaround. We were fortunate in that we didn't have any things come up that were any kind of a risk to human life. We had a couple of hiccups along the way. In fact, one of the interesting things behind the whole series of spacewalks was that the spacewalk that Jessica Meir and I did was actually a contingency spacewalk in and of itself. Because on the previous spacewalk that I had done with Drew Morgan, when we plugged in one of the new batteries, it actually caused a problem down the line in the battery charging unit. So Jessica and I originally had been tasked to replace a battery, and it turned out we had to change everything around and replace the charging unit instead. And the team came together and put together a plan for that spacewalk in the space of a week, and we went out and executed it, and it was an awesome experience to be a part of.
Well, we are talking with NASA astronaut Christina Cook about her 328 days in Earth orbit. When we come back, we'll talk about reentry. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We are talking with Christina Cook. She is a NASA astronaut and the world record holder for the longest continuous spaceflight for a woman. She set that record when she came back to Earth in February of this year, 328 days. And Christina, as from one woman to another, I just got to ask, you were 12 days short of Scott Kelly's record. I mean, why did NASA bring you back down? Why couldn't they have kept you up there for another 12 days? What's 12 more days after 328?
Well, yeah, I would have certainly been happy to stay another few days or whatever was required. But, you know, orbital mechanics more dictates our schedule than we do. So I was happy to come back when that dictated I needed to.
Okay, orbital mechanics, point taken. But would you have been willing to stay up there for another month or two if that's what it needed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're all ready for the mission that's put in front of us. When I launched, I wasn't sure exactly how long my mission would be, but I knew that the key to being successful in it was to not necessarily ask that question too often and to make sure that I put on repeat in my head something that would sustain me no matter what. You know, in human spaceflight and long duration flight, we have a saying that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And so my saying was it's an ultra marathon, not a marathon.
Okay. And you've also said that another one of your sayings in terms of how you dealt with some of the mental and psychological challenges of being on the space station for that long was reminding yourself what it was about life on the space station that you would miss when you left?
Exactly. Yes. And that's part of, you know, my strategy. Like I say, find a phrase and have a go-to phrase on repeat that is what you go back to anytime you might be missing something on Earth or find yourself thinking about how many more days you might have left or something like that. If you can focus on the unique aspects that you'll never have again, rather than the few things that you might be missing at the time, you will always be able to bring your best to every day and you'll appreciate every day for what it is. You'll be able to make the most of it. It is a privilege to be up there. And keeping that in mind and thinking about, you know, the view that I'll never have again, seeing the auroras, having the camaraderie with my crew. If I focused on that, then I felt that I wasn't constantly wondering when it was going to be over.
I see. So you said the views from the space station, seeing the auroras from orbit and your crew, the camaraderie you had with your crew. Do you find yourself using a similar strategy now as we're all asked to sort of shelter in place for so long?
I do. Yes, I rely on that same strategy, you know, thinking about the things that are unique about this time. For me, that's everything from small scale to a big scale. On a smaller scale, you know, things like being at home over my lunch hour, being able to exercise with my family, not having to sit in traffic if that's your situation. And then also things that are more philosophical on a bigger scale. It's been amazing to see how people come together, the different strategies we have to support each other. Obviously, we would never want this pandemic to go on, but seeing how we adapt and overcome has been truly remarkable. Mm.
Now, before we leave the ISS and talk more about your reentry, I've got to ask you, there's a terrible rumor that you listened to NPR while on the International Space Station. Is that true?
I did. I listened to NPR podcasts. We also had the various news shows like Morning Edition, and it was a staple. It was a good way for us to stay connected and to keep up with current events.
I love that. I do. I'm just going to say the idea that like you were waking up to a sun, you know, to your working day. What is it? 125 miles above the Earth's surface to NPR is fantastic. Was it useful? Did you find it useful?
It was useful. You know, it was great to have an audio platform so we could put it on in the background. And it was on as we were preparing our breakfast, kind of talking in the mornings and just to listen in on and sort of get a feel for what's going on that Earth below us.
Do I dare ask if you listen to this show?
I did listen to On Point. That was something I listened to actually during my exercise. It was one of the podcasts I had sent up. So thank you.
Okay, I can die a happy person now, Christina. Honestly, thank you so much for that. Let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Tree, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say I love your show, and I listen to it regularly and often. It's a wonderful thing to have. This question is for Christina, and I'm very proud to be able to talk to you today. But I was wondering if you or anyone on the space station got sick up there, and how did you address the issue if they did?
Sure. Well, things like viruses or things you might catch, we don't usually experience on board the space station because we have a very robust quarantine process that happens prior to launch. So I never had anything like that. But yes, we do have medical facilities and instruments and medications and ability to do telemedicine with our doctors on the ground should anything arise. So we were really lucky. We didn't have anything come up, but I attribute that to the great systems that we have. Also, interestingly, we are all trained in a little bit of kind of medical triage so that if something were to happen, whether it's an injury or an unexpected illness, we can take care of it on board.
Mm. Tree, thank you for that call. Let's go to Rye, who's calling from Rockport, Maine. Rye, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, thank you for taking this call, but my question is in regards to exercise, and you mentioned that you do 2 hours of exercise a day. And I'm curious how you execute that without gravity. I'm assuming lots of resistance type of thing, but could you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Yes, you're exactly right. It is a challenge. So we incorporate both resistance training and cardiovascular. The cardiovascular is either biking, which the fun thing about the bicycle that we use is it doesn't have a seat because you don't need a seat in microgravity. We just have the pedals and a couple handles. So that's one way that we do it. And then we also can run on a space treadmill. And how we do that is we wear a harness similar to like a giant backpack that has bungees that actually bungees us down to the base of the treadmill so we can run. It's a little awkward at first, but it does kind of exercise that cardiovascular need that your body has. And then there's an entire piece of equipment for the resistance training. It doesn't use bands like you might expect. It uses kind of a vacuum piston system to create different levels of resistance. And so that's how we actually keep our muscles healthy.
Well, Rye, thank you for that call. Christina, so let's talk about reentry and what it's been like for you after you got back from those 328 days. The world saw these fantastic photographs of you emerging from the Soyuz capsule when you landed in February of this year with this huge grin on your face and that thumbs up. I mean, how did it feel when you first got back?
It was an incredible feeling. I had been imagining that moment of coming out of the capsule for a little while, and I had prepared myself for how it might feel to see all those human faces again after only seeing 11 for the last 11 months. But even with all that preparation, I was rendered completely speechless. I looked down, I saw a sea of people, and all I could rely on was the fact that my flight doctor and I had decided on a symbol that I would give her, a sign that meant that I was doing okay. And that was a thumbs up. Uh-huh. So even though I was stunned in the moment, I just relied on that. And I thought, throw the thumbs up. And so that's where that came from. And it was just this amazing moment of recognizing that I was back, taking in the sights, the sounds, the smells of Earth, and knowing that pretty soon my feet were going to be on the ground.
That's so interesting, because I was going to ask you about the smells and the sounds too, right? Because sight is one thing that we would obviously think about, or many of us might, in terms of things that you would miss, the ocean, trees, birds, etc. But even the smells and sounds are gone when you're in space. What was it, kind of a shock to have all of that sensory input come back at once almost?
Yes, it definitely was, especially when I came out of the capsule. But there was even the moment when I was still in the capsule where I kind of had an opportunity to get used to it. And that's when the search and rescue forces were walking around our capsule. So for the first time in 11 months, I looked out the window and there was a person out there walking around and, you know, making noise and moving things. And that was one of the biggest surprises as well. Obviously, even though I knew there were going to be people out there, to see another person outside my window was quite a surprise.
And what were the changes that you immediately felt physically to your body, right? Because 328 days in micro or zero gravity, one of the things that NASA is trying to understand is how that changes a human body. So what changed in you?
Yes. The most immediate thing that I noticed when we landed was how heavy my body felt, but it didn't feel uniformly heavy like I expected. It actually felt oddly heavy in different parts. So for example, my arm would feel heavier than I expected. And one of the kind of results of this is that when I first was trying to move around on my, you know, medical cot, I would try to sit up and I might actually overshoot and then just go toppling over in the other direction. So learning your body again, all the, you know, they call it proprioception, where knowing where your body is relative to itself and being able to move it around in, you know, a predictable way and counteract gravity was all things that immediately I had to get used to again.
And how long was the transition period between your actual first arrival back to Earth and when NASA sort of let you go home and kind of be in society?
Yep. It was, for me, a couple days. We are returned to Houston within 24 hours. And then I stayed at a NASA kind of medical facility and dorm for just a couple days. And then I went home after that. So it wasn't too long. I was still a little unsteady on my feet when I left. But for the most part, the biggest obstacles of reconditioning and reintegration and getting, you know, my balance back had already passed after only a couple days.
The biggest physical obstacles. Okay. What about, were there psychological obstacles? Because as you said, for 328 days, you'd only seen or been in the company of 11 other people. And then here you are back on Earth with potentially, before shutdown, thousands or tens of thousands of people.
Yes, definitely. You know, those mental readaptation challenges are a big part of our entire strategy for coming back and reintegrating. And interestingly, one of the things that astronauts have the most trouble with when they come back are things that the rest of us see as very simple. Things like going to a busy grocery store and being surrounded by a lot of people in that respect, ordering off of a menu. You know, we are not used to choice. We're not used to a wide range of options. Every decision has pretty much been made for us in the last 11 or so months and has been done so, you know, without, like you say, being in the company of a lot of people at once. So I feel really fortunate that for a couple of weeks, I did get to reintegrate into society like that and did get to kind of overcome some of those hurdles before we sort of went back into isolation.
But, so I should note that you have actually experienced this kind of isolation before because you were a research associate with the U.S. Antarctic program for years, right? Even spending winters in Antarctica.
Yes, I spent a year working at the South Pole Station in Antarctica, and actually a lot of the strategies that I developed there to get through that long winter season, I found myself using in space and even using again now as we're all under stay at home.
Like what?
The mental strategy of just, like you said, focusing on the unique things that you have in the present rather than the things that you are missing, you know, coming up with a schedule and setting realistic goals for yourself that are achievable, you know, finding that work life balance when you share the same space for both. So all of those strategies that we've been talking about and that hopefully folks have been utilizing today, I started utilizing way back when I was working in the Antarctic program.
So whether in Antarctica or on the ISS, did you ever feel lonely?
You know, loneliness is definitely something that I think people struggle with in those situations. But I think the hardest type of loneliness is actually the loneliness that we sometimes experience when we are surrounded by people. And that can happen on the International Space Station, but it can also happen here at home. And that's why I think that having reaching out and forming special connections with people, especially during times like this, you know, taking the time to ask people what they need, what are the things that they're finding difficult right now, and maybe seeing how we can support each other and provide those things that we all need is something that we can all use to combat loneliness.
So we've got about 2 minutes left, Christina. I'm just wondering, astronauts are in this very rare position, right? Like you said, it's a privilege. There's only a tiny handful of human beings who've ever experienced what you have experienced. Given that, like, what is your advice for everyone listening, for everyone who looks upon you and your experience in space and wants to learn? What would you tell humanity right now?
Well, there's a couple things. When I think about the big takeaways of my mission overall, the biggest one that I think about is humility. Recognizing that it's okay to ask for help, to rely on the people around you, being humble to be a part of something so great, to have been trained by experts, to be working with a team of people that are so good at what they do that can overcome these amazing engineering and scientific feats. So humility and incorporating that into my day-to-day has been a big takeaway of the mission. And then also I would say building in resiliency. The Human Spaceflight Program does a great job of this by making sure that we actually build in margin for everything we do. Even though that might mean we take a hit on efficiency, we recognize that we always have to be ready for the unexpected. We don't know when that emergency is going to come. So we need an excess of power from our solar arrays. We need an excess of energy from our crew members. We need an excess of time and in our ops tempo to accommodate that. So just like this pandemic may be teaching us that there's a balance between efficiency and resiliency, I think recognizing how the example of human spaceflight really walks that line well has been a big takeaway for me.
Well, Christina Cook is a NASA astronaut, former flight engineer on the International Space Station for exhibitions 59, 60, and 61. She holds the record for the longest continuous space flight for any woman ever, 328 days. Christina Cook, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you. The pleasure's been all mine, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. I could
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.